This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Glad you could be with us this afternoon. You know, we're just now a couple of weeks away from the deadline for filing our 2007 tax returns. So today we're very pleased to welcome back to the program tax experts Marty Verdick and John Breen of RSM McGladrey Incorporated. They've joined us on many occasions over the years to help us with last-minute questions about filing those 1040s. So if you've got a tax question, give us a call this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. John Breen is Director of Tax Services for RSM McGladrey. Marty Verdick is Managing Director of RSM McGladrey Incorporated's Tax Department. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Good afternoon. Happy to do it again.
It's really a crazy time.
Yeah, it's hectic.
For you guys at this point.
It's hectic.
Yeah.
No question about it.
Yeah. Well, spring is on the horizon, right? April 15th.
April 15th, just 2 weeks from yesterday.
Yeah, 2 weeks away. Wow. Well, maybe we could talk about at the outset here, this late in the game, is there anything we can do now, 2 weeks away from filing that return, to cut our 2007 tax bill?
Well, there are a few things. If a person is eligible for a deductible IRA contribution, and there are limits on eligibility, that's one of the things that a person can still do. You have until the due date of the tax return, so just another couple of weeks to make those deposits. If an individual has self-employment income, rather than being an employee, they could have one of several types of self-employed retirement plans that they could still create and fund at this point and get a deduction on last year's tax return. There aren't a lot of other things that you can do after the fact, kind of post-mortem planning, to go back and save taxes on last year's return. The most common ones would be the IRAs and the self-employed retirement plan contributions that might be able to be made.
Okay. Anything new that's significant in tax law for this year, 2007, for those of us filing?
Well, I think the biggest thing is probably the economic stimulus payments that are going to be coming out for a lot of people sometime in May. We get a lot of questions about that, and actually our software on our transmittal letters even kind of goes through and projects out what we think a person will have as far as their projected economic stimulus payment. And there seems to be a lot of confusion out there about that, you know, from the standpoint of, am I eligible? Mm-hmm. What are the qualifications? There's a lot of people that assume they're eligible that are not. And some of that, I think, was driven around the fact that when this first came out, there was a lot of question about, you know, do I have to have wages? Do I have to have, you know, various and sundry other things? And, you know, most of those things have been, you know, pretty well ironed out. One thing that is kind of pertinent, though, is if you're using direct deposit for your refund, then the IRS will deposit that economic stimulus check into that same bank account. If you are not using direct deposit, then you'll receive a paper check, and that actually will delay things from the standpoint of when you might actually receive that check later on.
Yeah.
One other thing relating to that is that there are individuals who previously may not have had to file a tax return because their level of income is low enough that they were exempt from filing, and they are going to have to file a 2007 tax return to get that refund. So I've seen a few situations where a client might bring in a parent's information where they previously didn't have to file because they only had Social Security income and a few things like that. And they've had to file tax returns in order to get the economic stimulus rebate, the refund that they are entitled to. But if they don't file a tax return, they're not going to get that. So
okay.
We are seeing some activity there.
Okay. So that would involve, what, filing a 1040 easy?
Yeah, just the simplest of forms. And they're not going to owe any tax with the return, so
right.
It's a bit of a nuisance to have to do it.
Yeah.
But it's a necessary evil. The other choice is if you don't file, you don't get the rebate check that you would otherwise be entitled to. And that could be as much as $1,200 on a joint tax return. I mean, that's assuming no children, the maximum for a joint return would be $1,200.
Yeah, I can buy some groceries.
You could do something with it, maybe
yeah.
even buy a couple of tanks of gas.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with a listener now in Champaign. Line one, good afternoon.
Oh, I have actually two questions. One is for myself. I am retired, and I get Form 1099-R to file.
Sure.
And according to the things I've gotten from the IRS on the economic stimulus, it's going to be based on earned income, which our pensions are not considered earned income. Does that mean I'm not eligible for the stimulus payment?
No, you will be eligible. And John, do you have the exact wording in front of you there? Initially the expectation or the thought was that it did have to be earned income. But now they've expanded that, and it is not restricted to earned income. For example, someone with just Social Security income would be eligible for that.
Well, that's what my brother's on Social Security, and I got the information for him because I'm his payee.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, if he's eligible, I should be based on my private pension.
Yes.
But when the wording came out in the letter they sent saying earned income, that had me very concerned. But when I called CSRS, of course, they were like, what?
Yeah. Yeah. Hello. As they say, initially, the use of the term earned income was a little confusing because people interpreted that literally as though it had to be earned income.
Mm-hmm.
But you will be eligible for that based upon the fact that you have that income.
Okay. And the other question is about my brother, because in the mail, IRS was kind enough to send him the forms, which consist of a 1040A, which mm-hmm. is a lot more complicated than the easy form, which was what I was assuming I would fill out.
Mm-hmm.
Will the easy form work just as well?
Sure. Yeah, any tax return, and an easy 1040 easy satisfies the filing requirement. And it is a simpler form than the 1040A, and the 1040A is considerably simpler than the normal 1040. But any of those would establish the fact that you would be eligible for that. And John, did you find the language where it talks about it?
Yeah, actually, there's what's called the special ground rules applying to minimum rebates, and it must be $3,000 in total income from earned income, Social Security benefits, certain veterans benefits, or net income tax liability of at least a dollar.
Okay, so since I have net income tax liability of more than a dollar, that would be
automatically. Yeah, you'll automatically qualify if you have any income tax liability.
Okay, so it doesn't matter that my income is not considered earned; it's what I pay in taxes that matters.
That's correct.
That
will cause you to be eligible.
Okay.
Yep.
And one other quick question, and that is to pick up tax forms and the booklet anymore. They used to be available at post offices, but now they're not. Do you know where I could get a booklet?
Does the public library, John, still carry forms? The last time I was in the public library around April 15th, and I don't make it to the library this time of the year very often, but they did have forms and instructions available. I mean, my normal response is they're certainly all available online, but that presumes internet access. And if you don't have that,
I have it, but it's not the fastest.
Okay.
So.
I would certainly check with the public libraries. I believe they still carry them. And at the IRS office on Church Street, right near Westside Park, on the north side of Westside Park, is the IRS office. And they have a supply of forms and instructions available as well right out in the hallway when you come in the door.
Oh, okay.
So you could certainly stop by and pick up what you need there.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome. Also, I think at Lincoln Square in one of the storefronts, they had a volunteer group helping people,
mm-hmm.
and they
mm-hmm.
have forms there as
yeah,
well.
There's a group called VITA, which is Volunteer Income Tax Assistance, which is a group of people who receive some training and are available to help prepare tax returns of people with very simple tax returns.
Okay.
And I believe that you're right. They do have forms available there as well.
Okay, very good. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and we've got two tax experts with us here this afternoon on the program, Marty Verdick and John Breen of RSM McGladrey Incorporated. If you've got a question about taxes, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, let's talk a little bit more about these stimulus payments. Who is eligible?
Well, Basically, any taxpayer is eligible, assuming they meet certain requirements. Now, there's a basic rebate that is equal to the greater of two calculations. One is a minimum of $300 for a single taxpayer or $600 for a married filing joint taxpayer. However, the other piece of this is an amount equal to the taxpayer's net federal income tax liability, and it's the greater of the two. So if an individual, let's say a single taxpayer that has no tax liability, they just receive Social Security, they would be eligible for the minimum $300 payment. On the other hand, a couple filing a joint tax return that has, let's say, $2,000 of tax liability, you look to the greater of, but it's limited to $1,200 in the case of a joint return. So they would get a $1,200 rebate. So the range would be a low of $300 to a high of $1,200. And then there's an additional rebate available for each dependent child of $300. And there are some income phase-outs beginning at $75,000 for unmarried taxpayers and $150,000 for married taxpayers filing a joint return. And that phase-out results in the elimination of the rebate at $87,000 of income for single taxpayers and $174,000 of income for joint filers. So for high-income taxpayers, let's say somebody has $200,000 of income, they're not going to get a rebate.
Mm-hmm.
If a joint return has $160,000 of income, they'll get a partial rebate. So there's a phase-out calculation based upon 5% of the excess over the threshold amount.
Okay.
So not everyone will get a rebate. I guess Congress felt that that people that had that much income didn't need a rebate to stimulate the economy.
Okay, very good. And then the other thing that I read recently about this rebate or stimulus payment, whatever you want to call it, is that if you owe Uncle Sam money, they will withhold money from the rebate. I read it in the paper, so I don't know.
That's true. And John, if you've seen anything on this, certainly jump in. But it's not.
Yeah.
It is common that any time you have an outstanding debt to the government, if you are otherwise entitled to a tax refund, for example, let's assume that you just file a tax return and you are due a refund on that tax return. If you have an unpaid liability from a prior year, you're not going to get that refund. They're going to take that refund and divert it to that earlier year that you have the outstanding liability. And it is logical. I've not actually seen it. I've not looked at it. But it is logical that they would do exactly that, and they would apply it to that liability.
Yeah. It came in terms of advice of, like, don't go out there and use that money right now. Wait till you have it.
Don't spend it. Wait until you see it before you spend it.
Right. You got to have that little bird in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line one. Good afternoon. Caller in Champaign, hello?
Are you talking about line two?
Line one.
Okay, I'm on line two.
Oh, okay. Well, let's go there then.
Okay.
Sorry.
Hi. I just recently, in the middle of January, got an Illinois business authorization, and I was going to sell some jewelry that I was making. I bought supplies. I haven't sold anything yet. Do I need to file a sales tax return every month, even if I haven't sold anything?
Unfortunately, once you get that state registration number for sales tax,
yes,
they are going to be looking for a sales tax form monthly from you. They have no way of knowing whether you have sold anything or not.
Okay.
And so if you don't file that return, you will be getting a notice. I've had situations where someone got a number and then decided not to do anything.
Okay.
And a year later, they get a notice from the state of Illinois saying, where are your sales tax reports for the past 12 months? So if you are going to go inactive on the business, then you need to notify the state and let them know that you're not going to be filing. In other words, you would file I believe it's an ST-1, as I recall, is the form, and you'll file it and mark it final. But if you intend to use that number at some point, you should go ahead and file the return and just put zeros in it, and it'll satisfy them that way.
Okay, great. And what form is that? Do you know?
I think it's an ST-1, ST-1, as I recall.
Not the one to file with, actually, not to set it on hold.
That would be the monthly sales tax form, I believe, is an ST-1.
Okay, great.
I'm going
from
memory there, but because I don't deal that much with sales tax, but I think that's the form.
Okay, now let's talk with a listener in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Hi. Is that me?
That's you.
Okay. Should graduate students who receive fellowships also file returns?
Well, when you say file returns, you're talking about income tax returns?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, it depends on the method of reporting. If you are receiving compensation for services, in other words, if you're working as a graduate assistant and teaching classes and receive a W-2 form or some other form of reporting that income to you, then it's considered earned income. If it is purely a scholarship type thing, that's generally not taxable. And John, you're taking a quick look at fellowships there to make sure of any special reporting?
Yeah. Basically, if it's a qualified scholarship or fellowship that is used for tuition and required fees, then that is generally excludable. If it's for anything other than the tuition piece, though, then it's going to be, you know, at least some of it will probably be taxable.
So if you get a stipend for living expenses, for example, that some portion of that could be taxable.
Okay, yeah, I believe that's I'm talking about my son.
Okay.
He gets the tuition waiver package plus some payment for living.
That the payment for living, I believe, should be reported to him as taxable income.
Okay. All right. So he should file.
I would believe so, yeah. Now, if the dollar amount is small enough, he may fall under the filing threshold. Depends on what all of his other sources of income look like and how much this represents. But this would be, assuming that he meets the filing threshold, when including this income, he should report the portion that is reportable as earned income to him for these living expenses.
Would he, suppose he's not, he joined the graduate school in September, so he's getting only 4 months of that stipend. But if he does fall under that threshold, should he still file in order to get
stimulus?
The thing there is, who's claiming his exemption? Is he claiming himself, or are you going to claim him?
He is on his own. He's past 21 and living independently on the East Coast.
Okay, because that is a key item, because another one of the groups that do not qualify for the economic stimulus is anyone who's claimed as a dependent on someone else's tax return.
No, he is not being claimed as.
Yeah. Then I would say that yes, because this would be considered earned income, and that would qualify him for the stimulus rebate.
Okay, great. He'll be happy.
Okay.
Thank you.
Tell him not to spend it until he gets it, though.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay,
you're welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 800-222-9455, anywhere else. That's the toll-free line. If you've got a question about taxes, you can join us this afternoon. John Breen and Marty Verdick of RSM McGladrey Incorporated are our guests this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Well, speaking of students, any credits that students could take advantage of?
Sure.
Well, those credits have really kind of been around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
There's really two credits, and then there's a deduction available. There's a HOPE credit, which is generally for the first 2 years of college education, basically, which is a little bit larger credit than the lifetime learning. Lifetime learning, anyone can claim that credit who is enrolled at a junior college or a college or really any secondary, post-secondary educational institution. There are limitations on it. There are adjusted gross income limitations. So if your income is too high, you can be not eligible for that credit. And at the same time, you can also, in certain instances, elect to claim the tuition expenses as a deduction rather than a credit. And there are certain instances where that's actually better. Depending on what your income situation is, depending on what your overall tax situation is, you're allowed to deduct, I believe it's up to $4,000 of educational expenses in lieu of the credit. And fortunately for us, our software goes through and kind of does those calculations for us.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be, you know, somewhat of a complex calculation if you were trying to do this on your own by hand.
Okay. Next thing I have on my list of questions is, the last time you were here, we talked a little bit about the AMT.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, has Congress done anything about this issue since the last time you were here?
No. And let me explain what I mean by that. When you say, have they done anything, they have not created a permanent solution to the alternative minimum tax problem.
Okay.
What they did in 06 is they created a temporary solution that reduced the impact of AMT on many taxpayers. In 07, at the very last minute, it was like the 27th of December, something
right
like
around
that,
there,
right
yeah.
around the end, between Christmas and New Year's, Congress essentially extended that short-term solution. So the tax software companies were scrambling to get their software rewritten to take that into account. It is certainly not a permanent solution. Many, many taxpayers are still impacted by alternative minimum tax that you wouldn't think would fit the definition of people who should be targeted by this. The original purpose of the alternative minimum tax was to target those taxpayers who took advantage of certain loopholes or benefits in the tax law. For example, using accelerated methods of depreciation and some things like that. Well, what has happened is that the AMT system has remained essentially unchanged. And as people's incomes have gone up just through normal inflationary growth, they're losing the benefit of the AMT exemption because there's an income phase out. Congress can't write easy tax laws. Everything has income phase outs. And so people were finding themselves with limitations on the exemption amount, and suddenly they were impacted by alternative minimum tax for no good reason other than the way that the system works. And the problem with a permanent solution is they have to pay for it somehow. Any solution that would be created by Congress would result in a decrease in revenue because there's a lot of people paying AMT that wouldn't under some revised system, and they have to pay for that tax decrease somehow. And it's not small numbers. It's hundreds of millions of dollars, I would expect. And no one has come up with the easy solution as to how to pay for it. So they just do these one-year Band-Aid solutions, but we don't have a good solution to that yet. That's still hanging around out there. And frankly, until after the election, there's not going to be a lot going on in Congress. They're not paying attention to tax law right now. It'll be 09 before we see anything that really happens.
Yeah. For folks that are seeing that up ahead or right now, they're getting caught in this, is there any way out of it?
Not really. In most cases, it's not something that you've necessarily done that you can undo. Now, there are the limited exceptions. Let's say that someone has invested in certain types of tax-exempt bonds that create what's called private activity tax-exempt interest income. Well, that's an add-back for AMT purposes, and they could change their portfolio so that they didn't buy these private activity bonds. But generally what causes this are things like for the AMT calculation, you don't get a deduction for your state and local taxes like income taxes and real estate taxes. Well, you have to pay your income tax and you have to pay your real estate taxes. So there's not a lot you can do to change that. You might be able to control the timing of it a little bit. If you know that you're going to be in AMT in 1 year and maybe not in another year, you might be able to defer the payment or accelerate the payment of those taxes to get the deduction in a year when the alternative minimum tax isn't going to apply. Because if you're in alternative minimum tax, you're essentially getting no benefit or a limited benefit from that real estate tax deduction or the income tax deduction. The other thing, and I've had this happen twice this year, people buy the energy efficient cars, the hybrid cars, for which they receive a tax credit potentially. However, if you're subject to alternative minimum tax, you don't get the tax credit because the AMT essentially trumps that tax credit. So I had a client not long ago that bought a new vehicle that would have been eligible for a $650 energy conservation tax credit because of the purchase of this hybrid vehicle. And because they were in alternative minimum tax, they did not get the benefit of that credit. And it's lost. It's not something that's suspended. It's not going to be available for them next year. It's just gone. So it's the AMT has a way of sneaking up on people and impacting them in the most unexpected ways.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the credits for hybrid vehicles, where are we now in that story, John?
Well, interestingly, I mean, I think when we were here a year ago, Toyota was kind of just beginning its phase out, Toyota and Lexus. What you now have is Honda has now entered that that mode as well, that any Honda vehicle that's now purchased is in the phase-out phase. So if you would have normally been getting, let's say, a $2,000 credit on a particular vehicle, now it may be only $1,500.
John, why don't you explain, when you say the phase-out, what triggers that, the fact that each manufacturer is limited?
Right. Each manufacturer is limited to 60,000 vehicles. And once they exceed the 60,000, then on a quarter-by-quarter basis, they go through and start cutting back that credit. So when we talk about the phase-out, it's when the vehicle manufacturer has hit 60,000 vehicles that are qualified. Now, in the case of Toyota, you have to lump in the Lexus vehicles because it's the same, same maker, basically. With Honda, you'll have Honda and Acura. I guess the good news is none of the domestic manufacturers have hit the 60,000 limit as of yet. Mm. So if you're buying a domestic vehicle, then, it's not an issue for you, other than if you're in AMT. And then, as Marty said, you may be expecting this credit.
You're out of luck.
Yeah, that you're not going to get.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, if you've got tax questions, today is the day. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, how about some basic questions? If we can't file on time, what do we do?
File an extension.
Mm-hmm.
An extension is due by April 15th, and it is an extension of time to file your tax return, not to pay the tax liability. If you have a tax liability, it's important that you pay that tax liability as closely as possible. The last thing in the world, though, that you would want to do is go into a mode where it says, I can't pay the tax, so I'm not going to do anything. Because then, as opposed to having a failure to pay penalty, which is 0.5% per month, up to a maximum of 5 months, I believe, you instead fall into a failure to file penalty, and that penalty is 5% per month for a maximum of 5 months. So it's the penalty is 10 times greater. So even if you can't pay, you would want to file the extension and get that on record so that you at least will have a timely filed tax return, presuming that you file it by October 15th of 2008. You will still have, if you can't pay the tax, you would still have the tax due plus penalty plus interest, but it's a much lower penalty calculation. So at the very, very least, get an extension. You don't need an excuse. It's an automatic 6-month extension. It used to be that it was a much shorter extension, 4 month, and then you could get the additional time. But it is now a 6-month automatic extension. You don't even have to have an excuse. You just have to file the form, and the form is a form 4868. That is the extension form. The state of Illinois accepts the federal extension. If you owe tax to the state of Illinois, you would want to file a form IL-505-I. That is the state extension, but it's only required if you're sending money in. If you don't owe any tax to the state of Illinois, simply file the federal extension, and the state of Illinois will accept that as a state extension as well. Not all states are that way. So if there are listeners that might have filing obligations in other states, you have to take a look at each state's requirements. Some states require that you file an extension in their state, and they don't accept the federal extension as just an automatic extension approval.
Okay. Now, if I'm going to file for an extension, but if I'm going to make a good faith effort to pay what I owe, how do I, am I going to be penalized if I underestimate what I owe?
You will, but it's, if you are, as I recall, it's 90%. If you're within 90% of the estimated tax liability of the, I'm sorry, if you pay in an amount equal to 90% of what the actual tax liability ends up being, then you would not be subject to a penalty. You would still owe interest on that deficiency. But let's say that you owe $2,000 worth of return and you send in $1,000. That shortfall will be subject to a late payment penalty because the payment was due by April 15th along with interest. And that will be assessed by the IRS. When you file your return, you will simply pay the balance due, and then you'll get a notice back from the IRS that says you owe us penalty and interest. Generally, it's fruitless to try to calculate what that number will be because the IRS will calculate it based upon the day they actually process the return, and you can never know exactly what day that's going to be. So your best guess won't be accurate.
Okay. Does it make a little sense to overestimate a little bit?
Well, many times what people do, especially if they have to make quarterly estimated payments anyway, is they would overestimate with the extension and then simply allow that overpayment to apply toward their first quarter estimated payment.
Okay.
That way it's – in fact, I normally – rather than having a client pay an extension payment and make a first quarter estimated payment, I add the two together and intentionally have them overpay by enough to cover the first quarter estimate. And that way you've got a little flexibility.
Yeah, okay. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question about we have a Vanguard, it's called a contributory IRA in the information that I got from Vanguard. But one thing we did not get from Vanguard, and we didn't get one last year either, was a Form 5498.
Okay. The 5498, now, have you contributed to the IRA during this past year?
Not this past year.
Okay.
No, we're too old.
The 5498 is a form that is used to report to the IRS by the IRA trustee any amounts that you have put into the IRA that year. So if you are not funding the IRA, they're not obligated to actually submit that form to the IRS or to provide it to you. It's an informational form only.
One useful thing that it has is the end of the year
fair market value. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they didn't.
Well, you can certainly get that information from your regular statement. I assume you get quarterly or annual statements from Vanguard.
I believe so.
Yeah. So you could pull that information right off of there. But it's the IRS. I mean, there's that form is really informational only. It's not something that you would need to be able to file a tax return. It simply does provide you with some information, but you can get that information in other ways.
Yeah. Well, we're subject to mandatory withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, I don't think I've ever actually seen it in print anywhere. Apparently, once you're 70 and a half, you can no longer contribute to an IRA.
That is correct, although that would not be true with respect to Roth IRAs.
Yeah.
You could continue to fund a Roth IRA because that Roth IRA, unlike a traditional IRA that requires distributions beginning at 70 and a half, a Roth IRA does not have that requirement.
Yeah, right. Well, there was one annoying thing. My wife had a 403B account with Fidelity, and withdrawals from those are listed on income on line 16 of the income tax.
Mm-hmm.
But when IRA, when Fidelity found out they were going to be taking mandatory requirements, they insisted on converting it to an IRA in a brokerage account, and so now it has to get that bit has to get reported on line 15, I guess.
Well, IRAs are on one line. I believe it's 15. I don't have a form in front of me. And a non-IRA, such as a KEO or a SEP plan or other type of pension, would be on line 16. But
well,
it's just
SEPs apparently also have to come under 15.
Yeah, because a SEP is a version of an IRA.
Yeah.
It's a variation of the IRA.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, it's very annoying to have, because a lot of times the information you get from the companies does not say whether it's from an IRA or from a...
Well, there's actually a box. If you take a look at the form 1099-R, there is a box that will be marked if it is an IRA distribution. There'll be a box that says distribution code, and typically it'll be a code 7. That's the normal distribution code. And right next to that, to the right, is a box. And it'll say, if that box is marked, it indicates that it's an IRA. If it's blank, it's not an IRA.
Okay.
That's the easy way to tell.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. Next, we talk with another listener in Urbana. Hello. Line 2.
Line 2?
Yeah.
Hi. I have a couple questions. My mother-in-law was living with us for the last 2.5 years, and my husband always does her taxes. First question, she passed away in February. Do we still file for her for last year?
Is this February 08 or 07?
She just passed away this February, so it wasn't 07.
Okay, yeah, she still will need to file a 2007 tax return.
Okay.
And then also for 2008, she actually really has a split year. She will have a final tax return that will be through the date of her death, and any income earned through that date will be filed on a final 1040. And then after that, then there would be an estate income tax return requirement, you know, if she earns enough income, you know, through her estate in order to file that. What will sometimes happen on a case where someone dies early in the year is that for 08, you know, she may be under the minimum filing requirement on her personal return, but she still may have a requirement to do a Form 1041 for anything that the estate might have earned.
In many cases, it depends how assets are titled and whether or not there's an estate income tax filing requirement. For example, if everything was titled in a way that upon her death it immediately passed to the heir, so if it was held in joint tenancy, something like that, then the income after date of death would simply be reported to whoever received the property. But if there is if the estate actually has a period of administration where the estate is holding title to assets and has income earned during that period of time of administration, there could be a Form 1041, a fiduciary return filing requirement.
Okay, now she was living with us, and we had purchased a house a couple of years ago, so we moved into a bigger house so that we could accommodate her because she could no longer live on her own.
Mm-hmm.
The house is actually, now she was, I'm not sure if she's actually on the title of the house. We are the assumed mortgagees, you know, so she was not on the mortgage at all. We pay the mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
But I think she was on the, you know, to get the loan, she had to be listed as part of the purchaser of the house or something. But she, you know, she donated, like, money left from the selling of her old place.
Okay.
So I didn't know if
well, that won't have any income tax implications. There could be estate and other kinds of issues that come up, but the holding of the house there's no income tax implications there. And if I'm assuming you said that you were paying the mortgage and the real estate taxes, and so you've been claiming that deduction. So you're apparently at least listed as a co-maker or co-borrower on the mortgage.
Right.
Yeah. So, but in terms of the ownership of the house upon her death, I'm assuming the way that you've got it set up is that it passed to you and your husband then just by operation of law. You probably held it in joint tenancy with her.
Yeah.
And that's not there's no income tax implications of that.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Next, we talk with a listener in Sycamore, line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm one of those people that have to make quarterly estimated payments. And in order to do that very accurately, I try to use the annualized installment method so you don't pay any more tax each quarter than you have to.
Sure.
However, it would appear that if you go doing this dutifully through the year and then you find when you actually get your tax return form for the next year, that to do your April 15th filing, and the laws have changed, and suddenly you find that going through the new forms, you owe more tax than you calculated using the older ones during the year, making your estimations of tax, you could be in trouble. Am I right?
Well, you certainly could be subject to a penalty, which is one of the reasons that generally we set up estimates based upon the prior year tax liability. And depending upon your level of income, as long as you pay in either 100% or 110% of the prior year tax through withholding or quarterly estimates, you're protected no matter what happens. The exception to that is where we know that someone is going to have a decrease in income. So if you had an unusually large income, let's say in 2007, you might not want to make 2008 estimates based upon that higher amount. So then we get into the situation you're describing where you calculate on a quarterly basis what your tax liability is going to be. As long as you get within 90% of the actual tax liability, you're going to be okay. But if you miss, yes, you are going to be subject to potentially to underpayment penalties. Now, you mentioned law changes. I can't think of a situation recently where there has been a law change that caused a retroactive change in the tax calculation. So I'm not sure what law change you might be referring to. But the bottom line is you're correct in that you take your payments and compare that to your actual tax liability. And if you have a material understatement of tax, if you've missed it by more than 10%, you could very well be subject to an underpayment penalty.
Well, and that I understand, and I wasn't thinking of any particular specific laws that have changed recently, because I don't think they have. They've been quite stable, so this technique is quite effective.
It's,
but should they all of a sudden, like, for example, start taxing qualified dividends like regular dividends all of a sudden, and you don't find out about that until the end of the year, then oops.
Well, traditionally, when they have had changes in the law such as you've just described, let's say that we have an increase in the rate of tax on capital gains or the increase in the rate of tax on dividends, typically that change is only effective from that date forward. It is not retroactive to January 1st. So you would simply need to modify your estimated payment calculation beginning with the quarter in which that change occurred. I can't think of a situation in 30 years where they've made a change that had a retroactive application that resulted in a higher tax liability. I can think of situations where they've made changes that resulted in lower tax rates that applied for the entire year. So I would say that would be a fairly I can't think of a situation where it's ever happened. But,
okay. Well, in other words, it's not likely.
It's not likely.
Keep a close eye on the most recent changes.
Sure.
And you'll be fine.
You should be okay. And what you've described is one of the reasons, just the nuisance of having to do that calculation quarterly is one of the reasons that most taxpayers use prior year tax as an estimate. And if it turns out that they've overpaid just a little bit, you know, the time value of money on that overpayment generally is not material enough to offset the nuisance value of having to do the calculation.
Okay. Well, Excel makes it easy, so
okay.
I do the best I can.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Thanks for the call. We could probably squeeze one more call in this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guests this afternoon, Marty Verdick and John Breen of RSM McGladrey Incorporated, and they're here with us this afternoon to talk with us about taxes and to answer our tax questions. And we do have one last call coming in on line one. Champaign, hi.
Yes, hello. Thank you. Regarding making contributions to an IRA or a Roth IRA, is there any prohibition on this based on whether or not the person might have a pension participation or might be contributing to like a 401 type contribution program through the employer? Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, yes, there are. There's actually different sets of limitations for that. And if you are covered by a retirement plan, generally you have an AGI or an adjusted gross income limit that you're going to reach that, you know, once you exceed that, you will no longer be eligible for deductible IRAs, certainly. It also works the same way with Roths, that once you hit a certain adjusted gross income limit, then...
And the Roth limit is not even a function of whether or not you're covered by a retirement plan. Even if you're not covered by a retirement plan, if you have an income over a certain threshold. So if you're covered by a retirement plan and exceed these limits, your only choice would be a traditional non-deductible IRA.
Okay. And where... Is there a spot somewhere on the IRS.gov that you could find the rules,
the
nitty gritty?
Yeah, the instructions for the 1040 will walk you right through this.
Okay.
Yep. And if you do a search, you know, just do a search on the web for IRA deduction contribution limits, you'll find lots of hits on it.
Okay, very good. Well, we're out of time.
Okay.
Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon and helping out our listeners. Marty Verdick and John Breen of RSM McGladrey Incorporated.